I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ch. CTV's John Woodward joins me now. The award-winning reporter has been with CTV Vancouver for 7 years now. He's one of the top investigative reporters in town, most recently seen on CTV's W5 reporting on the Ivan Henry case. He's won a Jack Webster Award for his work investigating drug recovery homes, as well as an Edward R. Murrow Award for an investigation into problem gamblers, among many other awards. He was a producer on the documentary The Pig Farm, which was about Vancouver's missing women. His work there, as part of the research team, garnered him a Gemini Award. He was trained at the UBC newspaper, where at UBC he earned a degree in mathematics. I've asked Mr. Woodward on the program today to talk about his work as a journalist, about what's in the news lately. We've got municipal elections tomorrow, as well as some of the recent stories he's been reporting on. The website for more is at bc.ctv.ca. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program and studio, as it were, John Woodward. Mr. Woodward, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in to do this. I appreciate it. So we've got an election tomorrow, and I understand that you folks at CTV will be broadcasting Saturday night. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. There's a show, I believe it's 10 o'clock to 11, that's meant to be a roundup of all of the interesting races. And it's actually, I mean, surprising how we think about it now compared to even a couple weeks ago going in. Because I think even a couple weeks ago, people thought Gregor Robertson was an easy shoe-in, and we were all looking at Surrey as the big interesting race to watch in the region. And Vancouver's just recently become as interesting as in Surrey. And I think a lot of us are looking at Saturday, not even sure what's going to happen.
So when you say that it's become an interesting race, is that because you folks have been seeing polls that suggest that the race is tightening, or is it just, say, from the word on the street, people are, say, finally excited about the race, or not excited, but interested in the race?
Well, I would call my impression as the word on the street, or reading the headlines, or trying to take stock of how different campaigns are doing among different people. And so the early gaffes that you saw from Robertson were interesting, where he rejected, you know, Jeff Meggs in that so-called influence peddling scandal. He rejected his own counselor and said he's not even a spokesperson of mine, appeared a bit frustrated. So there were early cracks that were beginning to show. And when you add that into some of the other things that have happened, the Gregor Robertson brand is not now as ironclad as it was even, you know, a few weeks ago. So that's really opened up this race, and it's forced people to do a couple things. Number one, I've seen a lot better analysis of who Kirk LaPointe is just recently. I don't think people in the media realized that was an important story to start covering, and they've started to, and that's really great to see. The other thing that I think happens when these rates start tightening up is you see polls getting released that say, oh, it's tight. Mm-hmm. And that, I mean, again, like you say, I don't know how much stock to put into the polls, especially given that the voter turnout. Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, the voter turnout in Vancouver is catastrophically low, so any single signal can overwhelm sort of what the, quote, city would normally do. So you get everyone in Marpole marching out, for example. You would see that would be a big factor in an election. So you see a poll like that, it says it's close, and that, I think, mobilizes the base to get out and vote. So maybe that's another signal that the Robertson campaign is hoping to get by highlighting polls like that. They'll get their vote out, and they may yet win this thing.
You mentioned Surrey. That's a race that a lot of us have been paying attention to, even if we don't live in Surrey. At this point, Friday afternoon, is it still a three-way race, do you think?
I think so, yeah. I think so. I mean, you have, I think depending on how you read it, my personal inclination, and I'm probably proved wrong in this tomorrow, but is Linda Heppner is the favorite because she is still basking in the Diane Watts glow. But from Berinda Rasota, you've got a serious challenger, somebody who was actually on the inside in that council and who knows what went on inside that council and so has been furiously campaigning. So she's definitely a contender. And then on the other side of it, you've got Doug McCallum, who, despite it being years ago that he was mayor for a long time as well. So his name is almost synonymous with the mayoralty, and in local elections, name recognition matters. He's also been campaigning a lot on the public safety platform, which is another huge issue in Surrey right now. So he's a contender. So it's a three-way race, definitely.
So those are the two to watch then, I guess, on Saturday, Vancouver and Surrey. The other ones are pretty much, I mean, Burnaby, I think we know where that's going, right?
Yeah. That's a lock. I mean, unless there was another candidate there who voted, or who was campaigning on stopping PDA, public displays of affection.
Sylvia Gung.
That's right. So, I mean, that was the news that came out of that election. Otherwise, it's been pretty standard.
And,
so,
and in terms of the polls, because I mentioned that polling and pollsters haven't had a good record in recent elections, do you take stock in the polls that you're seeing?
Well, polls are becoming less and less of predictors of races. I mean, back in the day when you had everyone with a landline in a public phone book and the pollster could just rely on that to phone a truly random sample, it was more reliable. And now you've got people in cell phones, they're not listed, they're not engaged. The pollster has to sort of go out and actually find people. And so in that process of recruiting possible people to ask, you know, there's questions about, in my mind anyway, about how that process works. And then the other issue is the low voter turnout. So if you're sampling 100 people and they tell you one thing, but only 30 of those people are actually going to vote, then your signal might not be viewable in a polling format. So there's a lot of dice that are rolling. The other problem is the polls are dated. So if you look at the provincial election just recently, I think the poll probably might have been more accurate than we give it credit for, but that poll itself creates news. So people react to that news and say, whoa, I didn't realize it was that close. And then you get these 10-second Socreds who come out and vote and change the game.
You know, just in listening for the last minute or so, you've been at CTV for 7 years. You've been a journalist for a little longer than that. I mean, it has changed a great deal, hasn't it, over your time?
Just journalism itself? Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, when I started, we didn't have a Twitter account. Yeah. I didn't have a Facebook account for the work I did anyway. We were still, and I people get surprised when I tell them this, in 2000, and I'm going to forget the date now, about 2007, 2008, when I started doing television reporting, we were still using beta tapes. Hmm. So that was what it was like back then. You would go and you'd take your tape, you'd go into the editing booth, and the editor would kind of roll the little dial around and find it and physically cut. So now it's digital. It's very different, and we are much faster at it. We're producing much more. So CTV used to be just a 5 and a 6 and 11:30. Now there's a morning show, a noon show, and all of the other shows done by the same number of people. But because of the technology, we can move video very quickly, and I think that's led to an improvement because you spend less time thinking about the mechanics of making television and more time thinking about the story.
And you also file, because I've seen you file for the national news channel, right?
Yeah, that's right. So I've always trying to fashion myself as a different breed in that I started doing print. And then became better at video through training at CTV, and now I do all of it. So I will do I'll do a television story, I'll do a news channel talk. Sometimes I'll run that TV story on the national, and then I'll write the web story as well, and I'll tweet, and I'll do as much as I can to maximize the value of the knowledge that I've obtained. And then just recently, there was the W5 documentary. Yeah. So that was another example of how information that's interesting and valuable can be told in a number of different compelling ways.
Yeah, so you, I referred to you in the introduction as an investigative reporter. I guess that's your calling card, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And because you've covered the Ivan Henry case for W5, we saw you on the National News Channel for that as well. You also do sort of, you were right there during the Zahaf Bibo story and the Yusuf Sai story.
Yeah, that's right.
In the summer. Do you pick your stories, or is that assigned to you, or how does that work?
It's a good question. I mean, it's usually a combination of the two. Mm-hmm. So if I think something's really interesting, I mean, Ivan Henry was an example of that. I thought that case was fascinating, and it continues to me to be very fascinating as it unfolds. So I was pitching that to W5 and to our local show and making sure that we were in the game and had that advanced knowledge so that we could make better television when the news, for example, the Supreme Court this Thursday came out.
Yeah.
So that was how that came out. With Zahaf Bibo and with Yousafzai, those are things. With Yousafzai, the original news came out of Toronto on that one. And so we saw that, and I remember thinking, oh, that's interesting. So I pitched that. With Zahaf Bibo, that was something that everyone was immediately there, all hands on deck. What is going on? So the first story that I did that day was actually about how BC MPs were handling it. So I was able to reach various MPs.
Because they were all locked up. And
yeah, they were locked up. They were in an undisclosed location somewhere on Parliament Hill and locked up, trying to, you know, reach their family to let their families know they were okay. And so, you know, we were able to get a hold of, I think it was Hedy Fry. We got a hold of Elizabeth May. We got a hold of a number of different BC MPs to ask what was their story. Mm-hmm. And one of the MPs I talked to had actually done a fantastic job himself of documenting what had happened. So he'd taken his phone. He was just walking along, and he'd taken his phone and was taking pictures as it was going on, as these police officers are running around. And he did a fantastic job of showing, sort of as a correspondent on the ground, what was going on. So we used a lot of his photos and the audio and some of the video from these interviews. Elizabeth May was able to set up a Skype uh-huh. from her office, which is sort of something you would never have been able to do in 2008.
How long after the shooting did all of you in the CTV newsroom figure out that there was a Vancouver connection to this?
Yeah. So one of the things that we do regularly when there is a big story, we always want to localize it because it means it matters to the viewers, and it means that that's something we can do differently than Toronto coverage or Ottawa coverage. So one of the things we do regularly is check things out in the court, and you put his name in and something came up, and sometimes it can be as little as a disputed speeding ticket, but sometimes it can be something fascinating. And in this case, it was an attempted robbery, I believe, was the charge. So that became fascinating. We dispatched somebody that night. I was still working on the MP mm-hmm. story at that point. So we dispatched another reporter, Penny Daflos, out to get that charge. She came back with it, and then that was sort of the tip of the iceberg. What on earth was this robbery about? It was a robbery of McDonald's on Main Street a couple years ago in 2011, I believe. And so that was so interesting. I needed to find out more. So we went to the Main Street courthouse that morning, and I said, can I have a transcript? Can I have a audio recording of the event? And I said, well, you know, we do have those, but you can't have it right away. You have to make an application to the judge. So I found myself sort of representing myself in court, if you will, writing an application in simple language and put it into the court. And the judge was great. He decided to hear it at 2 o'clock. And by that point, I think
2 o'clock of the day of the shooting?
The next day, after.
Yeah.
So, but 2 o'clock, so 3 hours after I'd actually filed, which is quite quick. And I think normally people don't get that attention that quickly in court, but I think he realized how important it was to the national conversation that information get out as fast as possible. So we got there. There was a CBC lawyer. There was people from the Daily Telegraph in London. There were people from CNN there. This was a big deal, and you could see it in the judge's reaction. I think he'd never had someone from CNN in his courtroom, so he was quite tickled about that. And so the arguments came out. It took a long time. We won, and we got the audio recording and a psych evaluation. And I still struggle with what that tells us. So I'll just lay out what, do you know, is this a good thing to sort of explain?
Because, sure, yeah, I think people will find this fascinating because this is a story that we'll continue to be talking about, I think, we're talking about it now as we get details about it, and especially the federal government's plans, I think this is something worth talking about.
Because, and it does have ties to the Yusufzai case as well, and I'll tell you about that in a second. So this is a guy who shows up at the Burnaby RCMP out of the blue and says, I would like to admit to an armed robbery 10 years ago, please take me into custody. And the Burnaby RCMP says, no, we don't have a crime like that on record. Leave. So he leaves and comes back again, tries the same thing, turned away. And then the second time, he's arrested under the Mental Health Act, because at this point, the RCMP think there's something wrong with him. Take him to the hospital. He's assessed. No sign of mental illness. They release him, and they bring him to downtown Vancouver at a detox. Detox rejects him, because he's not drunk. So he clearly wants to get into custody here. So he walks up to the McDonald's, pulls out a pointed stick, goes into the cashier there and says, and this is a quote, give me the money, homeboy. To which the shocked McDonald's employee says, beat it. Yeah. I called the cops. You know, it's a pointed stick. So the guy, Zihap Bibeau, just walks out and sits on the parkade, and or the parking lot, I should say, and gets arrested. And then, so what is really fascinating, and that we've been able to listen to, are the tapes of those court hearings that happened after that. And you hear a very confident, articulate man in Zihap Bibeau saying, "I would like to be in prison. I'm a crack addict. I would like to have this time to defeat my addiction." And there's, he doesn't sound crazy then. The only sense that there's a issue with mental health is later when a court worker says, well, he may have some kind of undiagnosed mental health issue. But so to me, that's a big question. How is it he was assessed in prison, mm-hmm. Not found to have some kind of mental illness, but he's a crack addiction, I should say, mm-hmm. and he's also behaving very bizarrely. So it's a question mark, and I think that should really inform what we do. Is he evil for attacking Parliament, or is he somebody that may have just simply fallen through the cracks in a way that wasn't diagnosed properly? I don't know if we'll ever know the answer to that question.
And then, if I recall, the day of the shooting, by 6 o'clock, you all on Channel 9 there had something about the local connection. Did you not?
I think if I'm going to have to go on memory there, I think we did have the fact that there had been an armed robbery.
That he had been here like a couple weeks before all of this.
Yeah, that's right. And he lived here. And, you know, the downtown east side continues to be a place where I don't even know how to put it. It kind of defies description because it's such a strange place where people of all stripes end up, usually with tragic, terrible stories, and they drop off the radar. So, you know, we would never have known Zihap Bibeau was there had he not done what he did. He might have that crack addiction might have succumbed to that. So it's a place where stories like that come from. Stories like the Picton killings came from. It's a place where a lot of people are in very dire straits, and sometimes they are able to be helped, and sometimes they're just not able to be helped, and terrible things happen.
What is it like for you as a reporter to have to report on all of this? Because this isn't all very pleasant stuff. You know, this isn't like the stories that Mike McArdle does at the end of your newscast. Do you feel down at the end of the day? Do you enjoy it? I mean, I don't, how does this affect the person?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I find that I it's very much not the person I am. I mean, I'm quite a happy person. I try to tell jokes. I'm not sure if they're funny. I hope they are. And so I find it actually quite strange to try and show my work to the friends that I have, because it's very discordant. They don't really like it. So I don't post a lot of what I do on a personal Facebook page, because it seems a bit, it might be a bit off-putting. But I think in my professional life, what I've learned, and I learned this especially in the Picton documentary with the missing women, was that you, in order to understand what happens in this world, in order to explain it, in order to fight it, really, you need to know it. You need to understand it. You need to find the facts, and you need to get past what I think a lot of people have are preconceptions about places like the downtown east side or things like addiction. Because it's only through understanding them properly that we'll be able to, as a society, deal with them. So I think my role is very much to shed light on those kinds of issues and those kinds of problems, a wrongful conviction being one of them, and putting myself in the shoes of the people who are falling through the cracks, or putting myself in the shoes of the people who are trying to fight these very big problems and wrestle with them and understand better what they are doing. Because that shows to the people who are listening and understanding, maybe there are solutions out there, and how better to tackle them.
On the Yusuf Sai story, because this is when I really noticed what a good reporter you were. You can see here; these are notes that I took the day of.
Oh, nice!
I watched the all three stories from the three channels, and the other two channels had the same video almost of the reporters. Very good reporters, your colleagues at the other channels, going to the apartment where this guy lived, where his family lived, and getting the door slammed in their face. You, on the other hand, you got the sister of Yusuf Sai on the phone. That was something that they didn't have. in terms of covering that story, because it seems like you guys were, all three of you were in the same vicinity that day. What skills, say, yielded that get, if you will?
Without giving away much behind the curtain here, the approach that I take to these things is that somebody's always, if they're in that situation, they're always accused. So they're not necessarily guilty, they're not necessarily innocent, and you have to keep a very open mind. And so that attitude helps a lot when you're talking to people that they know. Because in this case, the family members of Mr. Yousafzai were shocked. I mean, they were also from Afghanistan, different sort of migrations from Afghanistan at that point. They were at once very angry that they had been shamed like this, but they were also confused because they knew a very different Yousafzai than what presented in court and through those channels. So they knew a guy who climbed the chief with his girlfriend, and there's an astonishing series of Facebook photos of him looking very normal, actually looking very fit, with his girlfriend climbing the chief, and yet that Yousafzai stops, and then another Yousafzai begins with another Facebook page where you can see it's very religious and very not the same guy, but it is the same guy. So how did that happen? And so the commonality between the two cases that I was talking about, I think, is that one of the family members told me that between the time that you saw him looking quite jovial climbing the chief and this very serious religious person, he had gotten into a fairly serious motorcycle accident and hit his head very badly. And it's an ongoing research about how concussions affect people and how mental health can change people. And you can see this occasionally with hockey players and football players and so on who live concussions throughout their career and then come out changed. There is definitely a mental health angle to all of this. These are not, it's too easy to pigeonhole these people as, fifth columns, traitors in our midst. Yeah. What I think is really happening is these are vulnerable people somehow who are drawn to an easy ideology of a radical Islamist approach, because it allows them to take control of, I think, what are the demons inside of their heads, and it allows them to answer some of the problems that they have, and I think that's a tactic. So it's much, and so to refer what I was referring to earlier, understanding that process of radicalization is much, it's much better to understand that because you can fight it, as opposed to just thinking that they're evil and, lock them up. That doesn't help. I think understanding how people get radicalized, that's a very serious question that we need to answer as a society to stop more people from doing this. And the answer is much more complicated than I think we realize.
And the politicians seem to be in a different place when they're looking at these stories, because not these stories, but the political situation, because they think that it's a terrorism thing. Mm. Do you think the public, where's the public? Are they on side with the government, or do they, say, realize what they're seeing on the news and sort of reflecting that perhaps in their own thinking?
That's a good question. I don't know where the public is. I think the politicians in this case had an interesting experience because they were the victims.
Mm-hmm.
They were being shepherded around Parliament Hill while there was a shooter on board. So once you're in that situation, it's very easy to see the side of this that is someone's attacking you. You better do something about it. So I have a lot of sympathy for that point of view, and I think that's essentially what we all agree with. We all want to stop whoever is attacking our nation's soldiers and our nation's institutions. Are they listening? I would hope they are.
Uh-huh.
If I was in a situation like that, I would want to know everything. And I would devour all of the information I could to make sure that I was making the correct choices. So I would hope that they are as well.
Do you hear back from viewers?
Yeah.
And do you get a sense of what they're thinking? I mean, do you get criticism for your work, say?
Oh, yeah, definitely. There's always... I mean, the thing about the media is that you put something out there and everybody sees it and everyone will have a different point of view. So I hear all kinds of things, yeah. I mean, the challenge is I hope that when I hear things, I hope I hear from a variety of people in a different spectrum, and you get a sense that you're doing the right thing as long as they're not challenging your facts, as long as they're not saying you're biased with a reason, I feel like I'm doing a pretty good job.
And in terms of when you hear back from people, you obviously hear back from people with story ideas and the sort. But when they offer criticism or suggestions, say, about the sort of stories and your work, does it change your work?
I think you have to be responsive. I mean, if it's an honest criticism, then yeah, of course you have to be responsive. And you know, there have been some cases where I've said the wrong thing, or not the wrong thing, but a poorly worded thing that's because of the ambiguity, people have heard different things. And I think, no, I have to be a better communicator. That's something that I definitely strive to do. I was in just trying to think of a good example. There was live TV is also a struggle. So mm-hmm. say, you know, once it's out of your mouth, it's out of your mouth. So, you know, you do have to think very hard about how you're saying something as well as what it is you'd like to say, and hope that the criticism then becomes not on how you did or what you said, but maybe you should try this angle. Here's another interesting story you haven't thought about. Those criticisms, I think, are much more likely to result in new coverage and new stories and new ideas.
And we hear as consumers of news how strapped for resources newsrooms are and the corporations that own them. Is that a challenge for you? Do you find that we as a news-consuming public are well served by the news coverage that we're getting in this town, at least?
Yeah, I think there's two things going on. So number one, you're right. The leverage that media companies once had over the whole, over everybody, being the only place you could go to for news, that's over. And I mean, you're an example of that, right? So that's changed. People can get their news from anywhere. And so that has reduced the company's ability to make a profit, I think. But on the other side, technology has also come in. So a good example is yesterday at the Supreme Court hearing, where Ivan Henry was fighting for the right to be able to find prosecutors liable for what happened to him. And in 30 years ago, I probably would have been flown to Ottawa, mm-hmm. and I would sit in the court and take notes and talk to Ivan when he was there. And that would have been a big budget way of doing it. But today, the Supreme Court broadcasts live. So I could watch that where I am now. Ivan Henry was there, but we have a camera in Ottawa and a very competent reporter, Katie Simpson, there as well. So she's able to do it there, I'm able to do it here, and because we can communicate seamlessly and instantly, the coverage that results, I think, is as good as if I had been to Ottawa. So technology allows each worker to be more productive, and in this case, you know, be able to do more with less.
And so why journalism for you? In listening to you for the last few minutes, you seem an evangelist for your line of work. is it a line of work that you suggest for people to take up? I mean, when you see polls all the time, you know, where they rank where how people feel about politicians and lawyers and so on. And journalists, you know, they're just close by.
They're like just about lawyers, right? or below politicians, usually. Yeah, I mean, I look at that stuff and I think, do they really know what we do? And that's kind of what I hope. I hope what it is a lot of shooting of the messenger. I would hope that any viewer could follow me around during the day and look at the choices that I'm making and the words I'm using, and I would hope that they would see that I'm not trying to to pull the wool over anybody's eyes. I think that in terms of whether I would ask, whether I would tell other people to join journalism, I would say if you are, the business is still vibrant, and if you are interested and passionate about the news and you feel as if you can bring something to the table, then go do it, because that's the kind of people we need. We need people who are interested and wrestling with issues and do it, I mean, out of a little bit of a sense of civic duty as well. That's what keeps me sleeping at night, is that I think that what I'm doing is adding to the conversation in the world. If you're in it to be on TV, you know, that's probably not for you. If you're in it for the fame, again, the fame is less now than it has been, you know, in recent decades. There are different reasons that you can get into the business, but
if you want to go into PR or get a seat in the Senate later.
I mean, there was a study out. I think it was the Pew study out that said, compared to even 10 years ago, you know, where journalists are making less money now relative to PR. There are fewer journalists relative to PR. And So, you know, if you want to be on TV and make money, I mean, is that what the numbers say? Should you go into PR? People make that choice because it's an economic choice. I don't think, I mean, I may be eating these words in a decade or something, but definitely in my career right now, I wouldn't think of that.
Yeah. And I know that you're always working on stuff, and some of the stuff you can't tell us about because it's, you know, investigative work. But when you have stories that you're working on, do you find that because of your employer that you're able to sit on something for a long time or spend a lot of time on something that may not even get anywhere?
Yeah, you definitely run that risk.
Really?
Because... Yeah. When I think is a great story, I'll try and run it by an editor or a producer who will be weighing this. Everyone's kind of second guessing what the public wants, and so there are a variety of ways we figure it out, whether it's Twitter or Facebook or the emails we get or the ratings we get, and you can actually break down a rating by the minute or by the second, I believe. You can know when something's turning people off, so they run it through that sort of filter and. Yeah, there have been stories that I think have been great stories that haven't really made it through, and you know, there are other outlets for that. So, you know, it's not as if we're squelching things, but I think they look at certain things as being more interesting than other things. I mean, Zehaf Bibo, very, very interesting. Just trying to think of another story I was trying to do recently.
You always seem to be chasing someone down a hall or down a street with a camera crew following you.
That is something sometimes you have to do. I mean, we try our best to say what we're doing is we're trying to do a fair story. I don't think we can make any other promises because I'm not in my professional life. I'm not right wing. I'm not left wing. I don't come to things with a bias, and I try and say that as honestly as I can. But in certain situations, people are not interested in coverage, no matter who it's from. And then you have to make the call. Is this important enough that you have to hear from somebody? And if it is, and in the case of Ivan Henry, I think it definitely is, then you got to do what you can to get in touch with somebody. And sometimes that involves meeting them at a public event and saying, you know, you've rejected all of my other overtures for an interview. Can we do one now?
So for you, at this point in your career, it's still fun, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is.
It seems that way.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's something that is exciting because I try to be at the forefront of a wave. You try and be interested. You try and find something out first, and then you're the first person who's able to tell somebody about it. So that's really, I find that really motivating. But also, you know, I look at some of the people that we're doing stories on, and some of them have been truly maligned by the system or by... You know, in Ivan Henry's case, by the justice system, the victims in Ivan Henry's case also profoundly maligned. And there are stories like that that really break my heart. And I feel as if part of what I do is to give those people a voice and make sure that the people in power, yeah, they can turn the television set off, but maybe I'm there at the next breakfast that they're at asking them about it. Because so, I think that's important. I think people in power should have to answer to difficult questions.
Well, it's a pleasure for me to have you come in here and tell us about your work, and a pleasure to meet you. I appreciate you coming in to do this. We'll watch you Saturday night, I guess, at 10 o'clock on Channel 9.
Okay, great.
Well, do you know where you'll be on Saturday night?
That's a funny story. I'm actually, I was slated to be there, but I'm my wife is having a baby, and her due date is essentially the election day. So we had to make a tough call, and I didn't want to have to abandon my post. So I'm not actually going to be there on Saturday night.
It's probably a more important job, isn't it?
That's true, yeah.
Well, all good wishes to you and yours. And thanks for doing this. bc.ctvnews.ca is the website. For more, John Woodward joined me in studio here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.